Yeah, here it is. All right, so good morning. Welcome. This is Battle 241, second week of school, though we had Monday off. Hopefully nobody came on Monday. Here's a sign-in sheet. So go ahead and sign in. It's by alphabetical order. If you're not on this sign-in sheet, then you're not registered for the class, because I got that off of WebStar just a couple minutes ago. If that's the case, then you have to see me, and maybe we can get you into the class. I was looking at the schedule just a couple minutes ago, and I noticed that on November 22nd, I have a lecture scheduled on cardiac output, blood flow, and blood pressure. And I'm not going to be here for that lecture because it's Thanksgiving. And you're not going to be here for that lecture either, so I have to revise the schedule and get it out to you. All right, so just be prepared. There's going to be a change in the schedule. And a number of people have been doing the online quizzes. Very good. I like that. Some people have not done the online quizzes, and that is a way to really hurt your grade in here by not getting those course points. So if you did not do the online quiz, you have to see me. Probably not today, but maybe on Thursday during my office hours, that's in the morning, bring all of your class materials, everything that you've done in the class so far, if you did not do your online quiz, because I got to make up my mind if I'm going to drop you or not. Okay, so if you're not making progress through the class for whatever reason, you know, I got to figure out a way to help you meet those assignments. And if there's no way you can, then there's no way that you should set yourself up for failure just within the first week of school. Okay, so bring all of your materials if you didn't do those online assignments. Maybe you just didn't know how to mouse around on the internet. I'm not sure exactly what the problem is. Okay, but let's get together and work on it. Let's see what else. When you take an online quiz, a lot of students boot up the quiz, and indeed you can take them an unlimited number of times, and there's no time limit before the deadline. Once a deadline hits, then you can't go back and take that quiz. But anyway, if you boot up a quiz just to look it over, always hit save and submit. Just don't close the window. If you X the window, then it puts that little funny symbol, the grade book with a pencil or a piece of paper with a pencil symbol in your grade book. And Blackboard thinks that you're still working on the quiz, and it will think you're working on it forever, which means that it won't let you enter the quiz again and get a grade for it until I go in there and clear it manually, which is a hassle, because we're set up to automate all that stuff. So don't just hit the close window button. Go ahead and hit save and submit. Even if you have a zero on it, it doesn't matter, because your highest grade is going to be saved anyway, and that then means I don't have to go in every week and clear a bunch of quizzes out. I would appreciate that. Okay, any questions on chemistry that we've been talking about so far? We're looking at the orbital model, the solar system orbital model, and here is that periodic table. You should know what it should be correctly titled. Okay, and then you should know what the atomic number is. You should know what a number of these different symbols mean. Okay, like O stands for oxygen, right? And there is a table in the PowerPoint presentation that tells you exactly what symbols you have to know and what word that corresponds to. And then on the test, you're going to get a periodic table. And if I ask you for the number of protons in a nitrogen atom, how many would you tell me? Seven. And in order for nitrogen to be neutral, how many electrons does it have? Seven, right? But realizing that you have to fill these shells up, two electrons in the first orbital, go eight in the second, and the way to make an element stable is to completely fill up the valence shell or the outer shell. And that's how ions come into being. Okay, so we talked about a bunch of different bond last time. Covalent bonds, ionic bonds, hydrogen bonds, and that's in the order of their particular strength, and you should have some bullet points and the tip of your tongue to describe what those bonds are like. Like covalent is doing what?
Sharing
who? Electrons. Yeah, there's always going to be electrons in that valence shell. So covalent is sharing. Ionic is transferring. Okay, and hydrogen bonds are just due to the combination or the combining of polar molecules, so that the negative end of one polar molecule has a tendency to bond with the positive end of another polar molecule. Those are very weak bonds. And then, not included in your slide over here, is going to be the weakest kind of bond, and we're going to call that van der Waals forces. So just like polar compounds will associate with each other, nonpolar compounds will associate with each other as well through van der Waals forces, and those are extremely weak. I should probably put a slide in here, but when we get to lipids, we'll talk about those. All right, so we're ready to move on to acids and bases. Unless somebody has a question. Anybody have a question? Both projectors are on, pretty much working. Really nice. And I even have a cursor. Nice. Okay. So acids, let's just give you a couple definitions of an acid. And an acid is any kind of compound that releases hydrogen ions in a solution. All right, so how many protons does a hydrogen ion have? It just has one if you look at that periodic table. So it should have one proton, one electron. All right, that's a hydrogen atom. And if we take the electron away from that atom, what are we left with? What are we left with if we have a hydrogen atom and we take an electron away from it? We just have a proton that's left over, right? And that proton has what kind of charge? A plus one, right? So a hydrogen ion and a proton are exactly the same thing, and we use those terms interchangeably in our discussions. All depends on what we feel like saying. Proton, okay, or hydrogen ion. So here's a hydrogen ion right here, and that's the same thing as a proton. And any compound that releases these things in an aqueous solution is what we call an acid. So it can donate protons to the solution. And as the hydrogen ion concentration increases, or as the proton concentration increases in a solution, it becomes more acidic as a result of that. So the more hydrogen ions, the more acidic it is. Bases, on the other hand, lower the levels of hydrogen ions, okay, because they become proton acceptors. They might release hydroxide ions. And hydroxide is an OH group. It can combine with a proton to give you water. So if we add an acid and a base together, guess what we get? Yeah, we get water. They neutralize each other. All right, so sometimes we think of a base as donating hydroxide ions into a solution. All right, so here is a table that shows some common acids. Not all of these are important biologically. Phosphoric acid is a very important acid in our bodies, and here you can see some hydrogen ions, and these can jump off of this molecule, this phosphoric acid, and become a proton dissolved in water, right? And that will lower the pH. Here are some other very strong acids, hydrochloric acid, nitric, sulfuric acid. We call these strong acids because when we put these in water, they dissociate completely, 100%. When we put HCl, hydrochloric acid, in water, it becomes a hydrogen ion and a chloride anion, 100%. So that's a very strong acid. Phosphoric acid is a little bit weaker. It won't completely dissociate. And so we call that a weak acid. Carbonic acid is another weak acid, sort of like phosphoric acid. And this is the one you'll probably be most familiar with in this class as we go through this semester. And it can release how many protons into solution? I see two right here. So depending on the pH and circumstances, all right, it can release two hydrogen ions into solution. Over here we have some bases, because what are they releasing? This hydroxide group right here. All right, and this hydroxide can combine with a proton from an acid and form what? H2O, right? And that can be a very violent reaction if you were to allow that to happen. So none of these right here are important biological compounds, but we give them to you because they're pretty common bases found in the laboratory, and it's mostly you see it because of the OH group here for the base and the hydrogen group over here for an acid. So probably you should make a note for carbonic acid and phosphoric acid right here as being two very important biological compounds. So when we talk about the acidity of a solution, it changes orders of magnitude from 1 molar to 10 to the minus 14th molar, many, 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 many decimal places. All right, so if I were to write the hydrogen ion concentration down on the board, I would need 14 decimal places to write that number down, which is just way too difficult to do. So there's another way of writing the acid number down, and that is by representing it as a PH, little p, capital H. And as you see, this H right here corresponds to what? The hydrogen ion concentration, or the protons that are in solution. The P right here is just representative of some mathematical formula that we take a number and convert it into one that's easily written down. All right, so pH is a symbol for the hydrogen ion concentration in a solution. The pH scale runs from 0 to 14, which is a lot easier number to write down on the board as opposed to 14 decimal places. All right, and this is the equation that we use. And you got to be familiar with this equation. That's why you have to have a non-graphing scientific calculator for the test. So the pH is going to be the log of 1 over the hydrogen ion concentration. So if I give you the hydrogen ion concentration in a molar form, like 10 to the minus 5, then punch that into your calculator and you'll get a pH number right here. There's another way of writing that down. You could say pH is equal to minus the log of the hydrogen ion concentration. That's another way of writing this equation, and you might wish to use that with your calculator. Your lab instructors will be happy to show you how to use your calculator, and I'll be happy to show you how to use your calculator during office hours, but I won't be happy to show you how to use your calculator during a test. Okay, and everybody's calculator is different in the sequence of the numbers that you have to program. Okay, and that's why I would not be happy to show you during the test, because chances are I might not know how to do it in just a split second. All right, so you got to practice with your calculator. All right, so we said that if we add an acid and a base together, what do we get? We get water, a neutral solution, right? And a neutral solution has a pH of 7. And where is this number 7 compared to 0 and 14? Right smack in the middle. So at this concentration, the hydrogen ion concentration is equal to the hydroxide ion concentration, exactly equal, all right? And it's 10 to the minus 7th molar as a result. All right, acids have a pH lower than the number 7, so from 0 to just about 7, 6.9999999. Bases have a pH that's greater than 7, all right, so 7.0001 to 14. So if you see a big number, it means that it's basic. If you see a small number, less than 7, that means it's an acidic solution. All right, so here is a table that shows the molar concentration of hydrogen ions or protons in solution. Here is one molar solution all the way down to 10 to the minus 14th molar solution, and what the pH number is. And you can see that when we take the log of this number right here, what you're really representing is what? The exponent that we have attached to the base 10 over here. And so this is a huge scale. We wouldn't be able to plot this out on a piece of paper, but once we take the log of all these numbers over here, then it's very easy to plot these pH numbers out. But just remember, the difference in pH from 0 to 1 is a factor of 10, not a factor of 1. The difference between 1 and 2 is a factor of 10, not a difference of just 1 hydrogen ion concentration. All right, the other thing I think you should be able to appreciate from this table right here is that if the hydrogen ion concentration, as we look at it versus pH, goes from a large number, 1, to 10 to the minus 14th, then what would be that 10 to the minus 14th if I had to write it on the board? It would be 0, right? 0.1, 2, 3, 4, 5, all the way out to 14, I'd be standing by the door before I wrote it out all the way, right? So that's why we have the pH scale. All right, notice that there is a relationship between the hydrogen ion concentration and the hydroxide ion concentration. All right, so when the hydrogen ion concentration is the largest, that's when the hydroxide concentration is the lowest, and as the pH, okay, gets bigger and bigger and bigger, then the hydrogen ion concentration goes to 1. All right, so there's a nice inverse relationship between hydrogen ion concentration and hydroxide ion concentration. All right, now this is a little screwy. Okay, we said that a solution becomes more acidic when what happens? What happens when a solution becomes more acidic? The hydrogen ion concentration increases, right? So as the solution becomes more acidic, the hydrogen ion concentration increases, but what about the pH number? All right, you're going to have to be aware of this because it's not really intuitive unless maybe you've had some nice algebra classes or something. But what happens to the pH number as the hydrogen ion concentration increases? The pH number goes down, right? They're inversely related to each other. I'm going to use that way of speaking a lot because we have the hydrogen ion concentration here and the denominator of this group right here. So there's an inverse relationship between pH and hydrogen ion concentration. So as the hydrogen ion concentration goes up, pH number goes down. The inverse relationship applies. All right, so let's just test your understanding of this pretty quickly. So I'm going to put a beaker right here with some water in it, and pH really only makes sense when we're talking about an aqueous solution. What kind of solution is an aqueous solution? You know what? Forget that question. What the heck is a solution? I'm using a word that maybe you haven't heard of yet. What's a solution? A solution is something that has a liquid part that we call the solvent, and then other junk that's dissolved in it, like sugar or salts or whatever. We call that solute. So solution is a mixture of compounds. The liquid part is the solvent. So pH really only makes sense when we have an aqueous solution, which is what? Now you can answer that question. It has water as the solvent, right? If water is not the solvent, then it really doesn't make a whole lot of sense to talk about the pH because we're talking about protons. So here we have some protons in solution right here, right, or hydrogen ions. And so what kind of solution am I making right here? Very acidic because there's a lot of hydrogen ions in this solution. But you know what? I just sort of tricked you because I'm not done drawing it out. All right, so now I've completely drawn this beaker of water right here with hydrogen ions and hydroxide ions in it. Now, what could you tell me about this solution right here? It's neutral. Yeah, that's really nice. And this is the only beaker that I could draw on the board, and you could tell me exactly what's the pH of this beaker right here. 7, because that's a pH of 7, right? Because it's right smack in the middle, equal numbers. Now, what about this beaker right here? Again, I'm kind of going in the same direction, right? And I'm going to stop now. Tell me, what kind of solution is that? Acidic or basic? Acidic, because there are more hydrogen ions than hydroxide ions, right? So this is an acidic solution. But I would have to tell you the concentration of this in order for you to calculate the pH. So I won't ask you the pH because I don't know what the concentration is. I just see that there are more hydrogen ions than hydroxide. But we could say, what, pH is greater than or less than 7? It's less than 7. Okay? As these things increase, remember, the pH number goes down. You might want to do that. You might want to do a dance because if you haven't thought of pH, it's really easy to miss that point. Right? Just say hydrogen ion increases, becomes more acidic, pH number goes down. No sense missing that really easy point on a test. All right. Now what about this solution right here? What about this one? Basic, right? Because if there's more hydroxide than hydrogen ions. And what about the pH? It's a big number, greater than 7. Okay. All right, so go ahead, draw that out just to make sure you get that inverse relationship between pH and hydrogen ion concentration or acidity. All right, we have some important biological compounds in our body that are called buffers because chemical reactions are very sensitive and dependent on the pH of the solution. All right, so basically we're all alive because of a number of biochemical reactions that are taking place in our body, and they're controlled to a large degree by the pH of your internal environment. So the pH is homeostatically regulated so that your biochemistry behaves in a nice orderly fashion. And biological compounds are very sensitive to small changes in pH. As a matter of fact, our blood is about 7.35. Blood is about 7.35. And if your pH in your blood were to go to 7.2, okay, does that look like a big change? Doesn't look like a big change to me, but you know what? That would be deadly. That would be fatal. Okay, so small changes in pH, right, have a major way of influencing your physiology. So a lot of times we eat things that are very acid. Okay, for instance, what's a compound that you've eaten lately that's very acidic? Probably some people know just from common knowledge, like what? Orange juice, Coca-Cola. Coca-Cola has a pH about 1.5, something like that. So if you go into 7-Eleven, get a big Slurpee and drink all this acid down, how come you just don't croak immediately? Because you have compounds in your body that can absorb protons from solution when you add them to a solution. And those compounds are what we call buffers. All right, so all the proteins in your body are buffers. Okay, but there are some other important ones like the bicarbonate buffer system and the phosphoric acid buffer system are important buffers. They maintain your pH when you add either an acid or a base to your body. So a buffer doesn't take your pH and make it go to 7, right? It just maintains it at whatever pH that buffer is operating at. Okay, which in our bodies, all the buffers add up to about a 7.35. Was that my mark I put up there? 7.35. All right, so buffers are molecules that slow changes in pH by either combining or releasing protons in solution. Okay, so they just keep the hydrogen ion concentration the same. So here is an important one. Here is a molecule, CO2. What does C stand for? Yeah, you guys have been studying a little bit. Carbon. And here is, that looks like a zero, but that should be an O. CO2, anybody know what CO2 stands for? Two right here is dioxide, right? So carbon dioxide, that's an excretory product. That's a byproduct of our respiration, and you're going to really love that molecule next week or the week after. All right, so carbon dioxide can combine with, who knows what this is? Water, okay, to form this compound right here, which is carbonic acid. And then carbonic acid can dissociate into this hydrogen ion and bicarbonate anion right here. All right, so here is a nice chemical reaction. And what can you tell me about the direction of this system right here? Can it go to the right? Can it go to the left? It can go both ways because you see double arrows right here, right? And this chemical reaction can go in either direction depending on what the concentration of these different compounds are in your body. Because the free energy change, and we're going to talk about the free energy changes, are very close to zero. It doesn't require a lot of energy to go from left to right or right to left. All right, so when your body produces a lot of carbon dioxide, it combines with water and produces what? Acid, right? It produces acid, right? But if there's something in your body that's producing acid or putting protons in solution, maybe you drink a Coca-Cola or whatever, there's bicarbonate in your body, what happens to this Coca-Cola that you're drinking? Combines with bicarbonate, forms carbonic acid, and that turns into CO2. And what do you do with that CO2 that's in your body? You breathe it out of your body. Okay, so here's a really interesting buffer system when we get to the respiratory chapter, probably right around right after Thanksgiving. Okay, you're going to be really familiar with this equation right here. So when we breathe out, we're actually like aliens. What are we breathing out of our body? We're breathing these protons out. We're actually breathing a lot of acid out of our body as a result of that. Or if we were to breathe into a bottle of water and put a pH indicator that could measure the pH, what would happen to that bottle of water that we're breathing through, bubbling through? It would become very acidic, right? So because we have a lot of CO2 in our breath, that would combine with the water and produce this hydrogen ion right here. So that's one way that we even excrete acid from our body is just by breathing. All right, so don't forget, this buffer can go in either direction depending on the concentration of acid and CO2 in your body. Okay, blood pH, here's the normal range. Acidosis means a pH of less than 7.35. Remember, as this number gets smaller, your body becomes more acidic. Oops. All right. Alkalosis, pH greater than 7.45. That's a pretty big range. Okay, so that's pH. Kind of a strange concept. What's the most important thing to remember about pH? As the water solution becomes more acidic, okay, which means more hydrogen ion concentration. What happens to the pH number? It goes down, yeah. So don't get turned around on that one. Any questions on that? I think if you pull out your calculator and plot some of those numbers out, calculate pH or given the hydrogen ion concentration or given a pH number, calculate what the hydrogen ion concentration is, then you'll be in good shape. You'll develop a little feel for what's going on. There's probably a lot of good questions on the internet too. Okay, let's turn our attention to some organic molecules. And I'm not sure everybody knows what an organic molecule is, but there's a difference between a biological molecule and an organic molecule. All right, an organic molecule has a carbon atom that is covalently bound to a hydrogen atom. So could you draw on the board what an organic compound is? Here is a carbon atom, and it's going to be covalently bound. We symbolize a covalent bond with a line to a hydrogen. All right, so what does this line really here represent? It represents, yeah, two electrons that these elements are sharing in a covalent bond. All right, so any kind of compound that has that general formula is an organic compound. But there are some compounds that are not organic that are important biologically, and we just looked at one. All right, what about this? Is this an organic compound? Why or why not? What is that? That's carbon dioxide. Is that important to you? Yeah, because it helps regulate the pH of your body. It's a metabolic byproduct. Is that an organic compound? Does it look like that over there? Does not look like that over there, right? There's no covalently bound hydrogen atom right here. So this is not an organic compound, but it is very important biological compound. All right, carbon has four electrons in its outer shell, right? Which means how many electrons is it looking for to become stable? Four more. So it can form four covalent bonds with anybody that wants to join in with that activity. Right, bonds covalently to fill the outer shell with 8 electrons. Okay, so here we see a backbone of carbon atoms all linked together with nice covalent bonds right here, two electrons being shared here and two here. This carbon atom then is going to be looking for three other electrons, and it can share three electrons with these hydrogen atoms. Right, and that will form a nice covalent bond. This carbon atom, since it has carbon atoms on either side, will be looking for two hydrogen atoms, right, to complement its valence electrons. So how many carbons do we have in this long backbone? Yeah, six, right? We call this hexane C6H14. So is this an organic compound? Yes, it is, right? But it is not an important biological compound, right? It's actually very toxic, carcinogenic. We want to stay away from stuff like this. Okay, but nonetheless, this gives you the basic structure of what an organic molecule is, and this is the basic structure of important biological compounds. This thing can actually form a ring. It can bend back on itself, right, and become C6H12. We call this cyclohexane. That's a really nice, stable form of hexane. And then even some of these bonds between carbon atoms can start to share four electrons instead of two, form a double bond right here. This is another molecule, okay, and these double bonds will rotate around in this ring over here. This is what we call benzene, and that's a very stable molecule as well, but it's not an important biological molecule other than you should know you should stay away from it because it is carcinogenic, okay? All right, so the carbons right here form an important backbone, and other things can be bonded to the carbon backbone. We call those functional groups. And then if we change the structure of this backbone right here, guess what we're doing in terms of this course? If we change the structure of this molecule right here, what are we changing? The function of it. Yeah, how it participates in your body. Okay, so we're going to see a number of different functional groups, and I do want you to know the names of these functional groups. So here's that nice carbon backbone here. This single line just means that there's a hydrogen atom up over in this position right here, so we don't need to draw it out in every particular case because we'd get tunnel syndrome if we were to do that, so we just draw a little line. So in here, on this carbon, instead of having two hydrogen ions, we have a double bond to an oxygen. So what have we done to this molecule? We changed its structure, we changed its function, right? This is a carbonyl group, a double bonded oxygen. So instead of double bonded oxygen, if we have an OH group up over here with a single bond and another hydrogen group down over here, this is what we call hydroxyl group. That's another functional group. What can you tell me about the function of this molecule compared to this one here? It will be different because the functional groups are different. All right. Here is a sulfhydryl group. Instead of an OH, this is a sulfur and a hydrogen. We're going to see that this kind of group has a tendency to stabilize long hydrocarbon molecules because an S and an H from one carbon can join with an H from another to form a sulfuric acid group, and that forms a nice bridge between two long chains. All right, here is an amino group, NH2, a carboxyl group. This is going to be pretty important. On the terminal carbon end, right over here, we have a double bonded oxygen and also a hydroxyl group. And it just so happens that this kind of group right here can donate this proton to a solution very easily. So when you see this carboxyl group right here, what kind of compound should that remind you of? If it can donate this proton to solution, this proton likes to jump off from this oxygen very easily. What does it become then? It becomes an acid, right? So carboxyl group is an acidic group because it can donate that proton to solution. This amino group can actually grab a proton from solution and become an NH3. And if it becomes an NH3, what has this become? It has become a base in that particular case. Okay, and then here is phosphate. It's a PO4. Here's the phosphorus with 1, 2, 3, 4 oxygens. And again, just like this carboxyl group, guess what these protons here and here can do? They can jump off the molecule, join the solution, and so this is a phosphoric acid group. Sometimes this PO4 group is what we call inorganic acid or inorganic phosphate, and it acts like a buffer, okay, but it's an acidic group. So here's an acidic group, here's an acidic group, here's a basic group. All right, so I have some practice videos for you to develop your understanding of how we name these things. And don't forget, because the structure is different between those different molecules, their function is going to be different as well. All right, so now we're going to talk about not just organic compounds, but these compounds are organic, but they're also important biologically. There's 4 major classes of important biological compounds. The first one is carbohydrate, we're going to talk about. The second one is protein. Third one is lipid. And the fourth one will be nucleic acids. All right, so those are the 4. Your first slide in this group of slides has those 4. Okay, so carbohydrate. Here we have a carbohydrate. How many carbons are in this carbohydrate? 1, 2, 3, 4. 5, 6. That's right. So there are 6. So that's a very common kind of carbohydrate that we find in our body. And on every carbon, except for the terminal carbons right here, on every carbon, what do you have? What are the 2 groups that you have attached to this carbon right here? You have a hydrogen and an OH group. What do you call, if we were to take that hydrogen and the OH group, join them together, what would we get? Water. So that's how this group of compounds got named, because when they started studying this, people realized that for every carbon atom in the molecule, what did they find? 1 water molecule. And so a carbohydrate is really just a short name for carbon hydrate. All right, so a carbohydrate is this kind of compound that has a water molecule added to every carbon. But we can see that the structure does change. Here I have a hydroxide group on the right. Okay, and then a proton on the right, and then a hydroxide again on the right. If we look down at this molecule over here, we see that we got hydroxide on the right and proton on proton. So this structure is a little bit different than this one over here. It all depends on what side the hydroxyl group is on. So this is a different kind of compound, even though it has 6 carbons. The one on the top is a glucose. This is a galactose. And then if we take the double bonded oxygen and put it on the second carbon instead of the very first carbon, then we get a compound called fructose. These are all what? carbohydrates, but different forms of that six carbon molecule. Okay, a little bit different energy level. These things right here are what we call monosaccharides or simple sugars. We do have some five carbon sugars in our body and other kinds of numbers of carbon sugars in our body, but this is, the six carbons are probably the most important. And just like that, hexane can form a ring to form cyclohexane. These sugar molecules like to form a ring structure as well when they're in solution. So sometimes they're like this, sometimes they're in a ring structure and they can kind of resonate back and forth. Okay, so I do want you to know that when you see this structure right here, that that is a carbohydrate number one, and number two, a basic building block for polysaccharides or complex carbohydrates in your body. These things are what we call monosaccharides. I don't want you to know that this is glucose and be able to distinguish it from galactose or distinguish galactose from fructose, but if you see this structure on a test, I want you to tell me that it's a monosaccharide or basic building block for complex sugars. Okay. So guess what a disaccharide is? It's two monosaccharides put together. Okay, so two monosaccharides joined together by a covalent bond. Here are some important ones. Sucrose, or table sugar, is a glucose and a fructose joined together. Fructose comes is a sugar that's produced by plants, right? It's found in fruit. Lactose is a sugar that's found in milk. It's glucose and a galactose put together. And maltose is just two glucoses put together. These are all examples of disaccharides. So let's look and see how your body, next slide. We're going to look and see how that happens. Polysaccharides, I suppose you could call them a disaccharide, but they're a little bit more complicated than that. Polysaccharides could have three or four or maybe even 1,000 monosaccharides joined together to form one molecule, right? And they're linked together by covalent bonds. Some of these polysaccharides are what we call starch. Another one is called glycogen. These are polymers of thousands of glucose molecules. So in starch and glycogen, you're only going to find the glucose molecule. No galactose, no fructose, or any kind of molecule. And when we say polymer, what are we doing? What's the concept? Basic building block that is joined together over and over and over and over again, hundreds or thousands of times, the same basic kind of unit joined together all the time. So a polymer of carbohydrate would be just monosaccharides joined together, but no amino acids, for instance. Nothing that would make a protein, we would not want to call that a polysaccharide. All right, so carbohydrates are important energy storage molecules in your body. And when glucose is joined together to form starch or glycogen, this allows organisms to store thousands of these glucose molecules in just one molecule, as opposed to having thousands of these things floating around in solution. And we're going to see that that solves what we call an osmotic problem when we get to that particular part of the class. You're going to have to come back and look at this statement after we talk about diffusion and osmosis. All right, let me say something about starch and glycogen. What's the basic building block? Glucose, and only glucose. All right, there are two different forms right here. Starch is the form that we find in plants, and glycogen is the form we find in animals. And when you think of a polymer, it doesn't have to be just a linear chain, but it could have branches. And glycogen is more highly branched compared to starch. That's really the only difference. But still, the basic building block is the same. So glycogen is an animal starch. Okay? So when you eat a meal that's full of starch, like wheat, okay, potatoes, what are you really eating? You're just eating glucose. All right? And what kind of person has trouble maintaining blood glucose concentration within a normal range? A diabetic. Okay, so do you think they should be concerned about starch that's in their diet? Yeah, because that's just like mainlining glucose into their body, right? And say, for instance, in the form of pasta or wheat products or potato products or other kinds of polymers. All right, so how does your body make a big molecule from a bunch of small ones? All right, the formation of disaccharides, and then you can apply this concept to making a polysaccharide by joining two disaccharides together or thousands of disaccharides together. And it's done by splitting water out from the two monosaccharides. So we said that a solution is what? Has a solvent and solutes. And the solvent in our body is water. That's what makes the solution inside our body, water right here. And things can dissolve in water if they're what kind of compound? If they're a polar compound. That's exactly right. So what about glucose right here? Is glucose a polar compound, and how would you analyze the structure of this molecule to know that? To be a polar compound, to have a polar covalent bond, it has to be bonded, an element has to be bonded to a hydrogen atom right here. But what can you tell me about the nature of the molecule that the hydrogen is bound to? There's a handful of them that will produce a polar covalent bond. Oxygen is one, like we see in water right here, that produces a water, making it a polar compound. What else? We said phosphorus, sulfur, and nitrogen as well. Okay, so here the sugar molecule is loaded with all these oxygen molecules that are covalently bound to hydrogen atoms right here, producing a nonpolar covalent bond. So this glucose does what with water? It loves water. It's hydrophilic because their natures are the same. They're both polar compounds. So water can form hydration spheres around this glucose right here, and so glucose goes into solution very easily. Furthermore, when these two glucose molecules bump into each other, just in this particular fashion, look what we have right next to each other. You have a water molecule when they bump into each other, and it can jump off of these two glucoses to form water, and then we're left with just a nice oxygen bond between the two monosaccharides, and then they're joined together to form a disaccharide, and if it's two glucoses, guess what we get? That's a maltose molecule. All right, so this right here, because water is coming out, we call that a dehydration synthesis reaction. All right, dehydration synthesis is when water comes out, and then instead of having two molecules, you just have a disaccharide. Or sometimes we call that condensation, because when you get water precipitating out on a glass, it's coming from someplace out of the air, and we call that condensation. All right, if we have a glucose and a fructose, that same reaction can take place. Here's an OH, here is a hydrogen ion. They can come off of these two molecules to form sucrose, and what's left over? Water. So water is a pretty important magical molecule. Not only is it the solvent that your body is dissolved in, but it participates in almost every chemical reaction that's taking place in your body. All right, so it's not just a solvent, but it's an important metabolite in your body as well that can be used or can be generated depending on the biochemistry that's taking place. All right, so here is basically the same slide over here. We could have maltose, but let's go in the opposite direction. Maybe your body wants some glucose to put in the blood because you're in a fasted state. Your blood glucose is going down. You have some maltose, and so your body would like to break this maltose down into what? Two glucose molecules, right? How can that be accomplished? Well, there can be an enzyme, and as long as water is available, it can split water in half. It breaks this bond and adds water to the maltose so that we end up with two glucose molecules right here. We call this a hydrolysis reaction. So large compounds can be broken down into smaller compounds via a process we call hydrolysis, and what other molecule is necessary for hydrolysis to take place? You need a water molecule. Okay, so a dehydration synthesis goes to the right, hydrolysis reaction goes to the left, and here you see another example of sucrose can be broken down into glucose and fructose with what kind of reaction? A hydrolysis reaction, right? So polysaccharides hydrolyze into disaccharides, then to monosaccharides via a hydrolysis reaction. Be broken down into smaller compounds. All right. Oh, for some reason, I thought we're going to talk about proteins next, but we're not. We're going to talk about lipids. All right. Let me just go back really quick over here. So what do you have to know? What a monosaccharide looks like, and if you put two monosaccharides together, what do you get? Disaccharide. Now, if you put a bunch of disaccharides together, what do you get? Polysaccharide. What kind of reaction would you use to make a disaccharide from two monosaccharides? Dehydration synthesis reaction, and the reverse is what we call hydrolysis reaction. Okay. All right, let's look at some lipids. So you got to know the building blocks of all these different compounds. So what are some building blocks of lipids? Well, let's talk about some physical chemistry of lipids first. Lipids are insoluble in polar solvents. And what kind of solvent is water? Polar. And you all kind of know that, right? If you were making some toast or a bagel this morning, you put some butter on it, it slipped out of your hand, and it fell out of your hand, how does it always fall, unfortunately? Butter side down. It fell on your pants. So now you got butter on your pants, right? Can you just take a wet napkin and get that butter out of your pants? No, because that butter doesn't want to have anything to do with water because the butter is hydrophobic. Right? Lipids, like that butter, are what we call nonpolar. They don't have any of those hydrogens bonded to oxygen or nitrogen or phosphorus or sulfur. They're only bonded to carbon, which is a nonpolar bond. All right, so lipids consist primarily of hydrocarbon chains and rings. No oxygen, no phosphorus, no nitrogen, no sulfur, just hydrocarbons. All right, so here we have a fatty acid. We have three fatty acids here, here, and here. So here's a long hydrocarbon chain. This can be anywhere from maybe 8 to 20 carbon atoms long. It can be a really long chain. And you see that these are all nonpolar covalent bonds right here. So this part of the molecule just does not like to dissolve in water. This is a fatty acid. We call it an acid because here is the carboxyl group. That's a functional group that we just looked at. And this proton can jump off into solution. So this end of the fatty acid sort of can dissolve in water. But this end of the molecule right here, the nonpolar end, dominates its behavior. So fatty acids typically are fairly insoluble in water. All right, so here are three of them. The length of these chains can be different. Here is another compound that you're going to be really familiar with. As a matter of fact, you should probably draw this compound out maybe 25 times before the next lecture so you see it. Okay, this is a glycerol molecule. How many carbons are in glycerol? Three. Now, if you're going to compare this molecule to glucose, what would be an easy way of describing what the difference is? Glucose has how many carbon atoms? Six, so if we take a glucose, chop it in half, what are we likely to get? A glycerol right here. Yeah, we're going to see that happen. All right, but it's not quite a sugar, right? It has an OH group right here, no double bonded to an oxygen in any of these positions, so it's a little bit different than a sugar. All right, so here is glycerol, and if we pair that up with these three fatty acids, guess what can combine from these four molecules? You can undergo a dehydration synthesis reaction by condensing three water molecules out and then forming a nice covalent bond between the fatty acids and the glycerol molecule. So this illustration right here shows you a number of nice things, what the building blocks of a triglyceride are, which is a lipid. The building blocks are what? Three fatty acids and one glycerol molecule. A triglyceride is formed by what kind of reaction? A dehydration synthesis reaction, just like when we made a disaccharide or a polysaccharide. So your body didn't have to reinvent any kind of new fancy biochemistry. And again, the water molecule participates in this reaction and is also what? The solution where this reaction takes place. And you're probably familiar with triglycerides. Probably we've all had a blood test where we measure triglycerides in our blood. That's a very important marker for cardiovascular disease and other kinds of metabolic disorders. So what's the building block of a polysaccharide? Monosaccharide. What's the building block of a triglyceride? Three fatty acids and a glycerol. Okay? And it's formed by dehydration synthesis. And I don't know about this last slide, no. What about the reverse direction? Can it go in the reverse direction? Can a triglyceride be broken down into glycerol and three fatty acids? Absolutely. By what kind of reaction? Just a hydrolysis reaction. So you need three waters, and it will break that triglyceride down. Okay. So here are some fatty acids. So I want you to know that these are fatty acids because here's a long hydrocarbon chain. Here's a carboxyl group. Here's a little bit longer hydrocarbon chain with a carboxyl group. This is a carboxylic acid group, which makes this molecule reactive, for instance, if we want to make a triglyceride out of it. And there is also another difference. This is what we call a saturated fatty acid. Because on every carbon position in the hydrocarbon chain, we see two hydrogen atoms. Every carbon, and this whole backbone right here, is fully saturated with hydrogen atoms. However, this carbon backbone over here, notice that there are some carbons that have a double bond, which means that there can't be hydrogens down over here, so this is what we call an unsaturated fatty acid. And there's different consequences to having saturated and unsaturated fatty acids in your body. It also changes the shape of these things. An unsaturated fatty acid has a little bit of a bend to it. So when you change the structure of a fatty acid, you change its shape, you're changing its function in your body. Okay. So I do want you to be able to recognize this as, number one, being a fatty acid and not a carbohydrate. All right, and that it's a saturated fatty acid. This one down over here, I want you to be able to recognize that structure as, number one, a fatty acid, because of the carboxyl group right here. Here's the fatty end of the molecule. Here's the acid end of the molecule. But this one right here is an unsaturated fatty acid, just when you look at the molecule. Okay, because the difference in structure will change its function. Okay, here is probably one of the most interesting slides in the whole class, but that doesn't mean you don't have to come to any lecture after this one, because there's still a lot of interesting things, but this one's pretty amazing. Okay, phospholipids. Okay, and a phospholipid is a lipid that has been modified by adding some kind of phosphate group to it. So let's look at this, and you've got to be able to draw this one out too, probably, or at least recognize it. I want you to be able to recognize this molecule in a couple of different ways. So let's analyze the molecule. Here we have a long hydrocarbon chain. That's what that R stands for. It's just a carbon bound to another carbon bound to another carbon, right? There are no oxygens or sulfur or phosphorus in this end of the molecule. So what can you tell me about this end of the molecule right here? It's hydrophobic. It hates water because it is nonpolar and it's really long. Right, here's another very long hydrocarbon tail right here on this fatty acid. And here's the carboxyl group on that fatty acid. What has it joined to? I see 1, 2, 3 carbon atoms right here. It has joined to this glycerol molecule by what, a dehydration synthesis reaction. So this is like not quite a triglyceride. Here's a diglyceride, because on the third carbon over here, we don't have a fatty acid. We have this other kind of fancy group. Right, this is a phosphatidyl group. You don't have to know the name of that. But here's a phosphorus. Here's a nitrogen. What does this phosphorus and nitrogen, and these oxygens here as well, impart to this end of the molecule? Because it has polar covalent bonds. So this end of the molecule right here is polar. The second end of the other end of the molecule over here is nonpolar. So what can you tell me about this molecule? Does it like to dissolve in water or not dissolve in water? Well, you know what? Yeah, it's one of these things that actually is very happy in either. And it's even the most happy if both of these compounds are around together. All right, so here is the polar end of this phospholipid. Here is the nonpolar end. And if we were to simplify this diagram, we can see that the phosphorus and nitrogen here produce a polar head group, and the nonpolar regions right here corresponding to these fatty acids produce a nonpolar hydrophobic portion of the molecule. All right, so you guys just got done with Labor Day weekend. Maybe you had a picnic outside, okay, and you reached into your refrigerator and you got one of these bottles out like this. And here is a little meniscus. There's a little separation between two compartments that you have in this bottle right here. What would you have to do to this bottle before you use it on your picnic? Shake it up. Because what kind of bottle is that? What's in there? Salad dressing. Okay, and the salad dressing has got two areas, right? There's the oil up over here, and then there's the water down over here. And if you just pour this on your salad, you're only going to get oil and not any of the really good tasty spices and stuff down in the water, right? All right, now when you got this bottle out of your refrigerator, did you have to do anything special to get all the oil up over here and all the water down over here? Or did it just happen automatically? All right, there's no little genies in that bottle separating the molecules out, right? It just happened automatically because oil is what kind of compound? hydrophobic, and the water is, and all the salts and other things, sugars and things that are dissolved in this water solution right here are what? Hydrophilic. They love water. Okay. And of course, you can mix this all up by shaking it. Okay, so now let's take this molecule right here that looks like that and put one of these molecules in the salad dressing bottle. Where is it going to go? Is it going to go to the top? Is it going to go to the bottom? Those are your two choices. Where's it going to go? It's going to go exactly right here in the middle of the bottle. And do you need a genie to make that happen, or will it happen automatically? It will just happen automatically. So here is going to be what? The polar head group. What about the nonpolar tails of that? This is what? A phospholipid. All right, so here you have a phospholipid, and it's going to go not in the top, not in the bottom, but exactly right smack in the middle. It's just sort of by magic. It's not magic because now you know what? You know something about polar and nonpolar chemicals. That's exactly where it's going to go. And as a matter of fact, if we put two of these phospholipids in here, what's going to happen? Same thing. It's going to end up here. And if we put thousands, what's going to happen? It's going to form something that looks like this. And if we look at this from far away, that's going to look like a membrane. Right? So membranes that your body, all the cells are made of, right on the outside, the cell membrane and all the membranes that organelles are made of have the ability to do what? Self-assemble, just build themselves based on the nature of the molecule. That's the basic building block of a membrane. And a membrane is one of the basic structures of life. So life has a way of just automatically building itself because of this interaction between being hydrophobic or hydrophilic. So that's pretty cool. So you got to know something about this molecule right here. This is sort of like the basic, one of the most important basic molecules, or fundamental, I don't want to use acid or basic, but fundamental molecules that establishes life. Okay. So instead of the salad dressing bottle right here, if we just have water, so here we have water, you see H2O right here. We don't have an oil layer. If we put a bunch of phospholipids in just a beaker of water, all right, then the hydrophilic head group wants to associate with water, and the hydrophobic tails don't want to associate with water. So now, not only do you have basically a membrane, but what has this membrane formed? It has now formed something that we call a micelle, and this micelle really actually begins to look like a cell, okay, with the interior over here and the exterior up against the aqueous environment. Okay, so that's just something about the nature of these phospholipids. The polar part interacts with water. The nonpolar part is hidden in the middle right here because it doesn't want to associate with water. Okay. There are some other kinds of lipids that are important besides fatty acids and triglycerides. All right, but I tell you what, what's the building block of a triglyceride once again? Three fatty acids and a glycerol. What about a phospholipid? What are the building blocks of a phospholipid? Only two fatty acids, a phosphate group, and the glycerol molecule once again. Okay. So here's another kind of lipid molecule. And when we look at this lipid molecule over here, I don't see very many oxygens, maybe just a couple. But these are all carbon atoms bound to hydrogen. So this molecule really doesn't like to dissolve in water very much because it doesn't have polar covalent bonds. And the structure of all four of these right here look very similar to me. I see a little staircase. I see a step here and a step here and another step here, right? And I see all these little carbon rings. The carbon rings are the same, right? Here's a 6 carbon. Here's a 5 carbon, 6, 6, 6, and a 5, 5, 6, 6, 6. So when I look at all of these molecules over here, they have basically the same kind of chemical formula. Some minor differences along the way, like there's not a CH3 here, there's a CH3 up over here. So these things right here are what we call, all of these things are what we're going to call steroids, right? Which are lipids. So small changes in this molecule means the difference between testosterone and estrogen, or a form of estrogen we call estradiol. So in your body, will testosterone perform a different function than estrogen? Absolutely, right? Like the difference between male and female. All right, so just this small structural change, right, produces these big differences. All right, and the basic building block of all of these hormones right here is the cholesterol molecule. All right, so you all probably know that cholesterol is not good for you and your body because it can produce cardiovascular disease. But if your body was completely devoid of cholesterol, would that be good? No, because then your body couldn't synthesize these hormones right here. Okay. So whenever you see this structure, you should be able to tell me that it is a steroid. I don't want you to tell me the difference between cortisone and testosterone and estradiol and cholesterol, but I do want you to be able to look at this molecule right here and say that it is not a monosaccharide, not a fatty acid, okay, not an amino acid, which we're going to look at really soon, but it is a steroid because of this staircase kind of step function to it, right, and all these ring structures right here. Sometimes cell membranes not only have a phospholipid component to it, but also cholesterol is added to the cell membrane to give the membrane some rigidity. Helps give some structure to the membrane. All right. Here we have another kind of lipid. We call these prostaglandins. Prostaglandins are important signaling molecules. They're basically a fatty acid. Here's a carboxyl group. Here's a long hydrocarbon chain. Right, and it's been bent in half, so you have a nice 180-degree bend right here. It's stabilized sometimes with some covalent bonds between the two ends of the molecule. And these then could be used as hormones or other kinds of signaling molecules. So they're modified fatty acids. Modified fatty acids can become important signaling compounds in your body. And so they serve regulatory functions. And it's a kind of lipid because this is a very large hydrophobic end of the molecule. It only has this one really small carboxylic group right here. All right, so those are the three main kinds of lipids that we look at: steroids, prostaglandins, and triglycerides. So if you have a triglyceride in your body and your body wants a fatty acid, it can go to a triglyceride and get it. What kind of reaction would it use to get a fatty acid from a triglyceride? A hydrolysis reaction. Yeah, hydrolysis reaction. Okay. Okay, protein. Amino acids. Let's take a look at a basic building block of amino acid. How many lectures were we going to have on chemistry? Two or three? Oh, good. Okay. So what do we have right here? Here's a CO2H. What kind of group is a CO2H on the terminal of a carbon backbone? That's a carboxylic group, right? Carboxylic acid. So here's a carboxyl group right here. And then on the other end, we have a nitrogen group. What did we call that nitrogen group? Amino group. When you go back and start to study those, here's the amino group. Did I pass the sign-in sheet around? I see some people sneaking out already. They're bad. Tell them they're bad. You know who it is. I don't know who it is. But anyway, make sure you sign the sign-in sheet. Otherwise, I don't know that you're here. Okay, so here we have a carboxyl group over here. Here's an amino group, and the carboxyl group is an acid. So what's another common way of talking about this kind of structure? This is an amino acid because of the structure. And then on the central carbon, sometimes we call this an alpha carbon, the central carbon right here on either side of this nitrogen and carbon, right, we have one hydrogen atom. But the one that's poking up, we have an R. An R, I don't think you're going to find in the periodic table. It could mean any number of different kinds of things. It's a variable group, right? It's a functional group that can have different kinds of structure, different kinds of shapes, different kinds of functions. Here are some nonpolar amino acids. We know this is an amino acid because here's the amino group. Here's our carboxyl group right here. And then look at the hydrocarbons right here. So here we have a nonpolar region. So here's a nonpolar amino acid. Here's another one called tyrosine, carboxyl group, amino group on the alpha carbon. So this is an amino acid. But again, here is another nonpolar functional group on the top. This functional group is different than this one over here. This is what we call valine. This is what we call tyrosine. You don't have to know the names of amino acids, but I do want you to know what an amino acid is. So if I show you this structure on the test, or this one over here, you should be able to tell me that that is not a fatty acid. That's not a monosaccharide. It is what? An amino acid right here. Okay. Some of these functional groups can have a polar substitution, because here's a nitrogen, here's another nitrogen that makes it very soluble in water. This amino acid is very soluble. And here is one with an SH group, a sulfhydryl group. Here's one with a carboxyl group in this terminus position. And when you change the structure of these functional groups, then of course you change the nature of that amino acid and you got to change the name. So this is arginine, cysteine, aspartic acid. All right, but basically an amino acid has exactly the same kind of building block. It's just that this one little functional group changes, which then is going to change the function of this amino acid. All right, amino acids can be joined together to form what? Probably before you took this class, you knew that. Amino acids is a basic building block for proteins, okay? So how can you make a disaccharide again? I forgot. Oh, yeah, dehydration synthesis reaction, okay? How can you make a triglyceride from three fatty acids and glycerol? Dehydration synthesis reaction. How can you make a dipeptide from two amino acids? A dehydration synthesis reaction, right? Because on the amino group, here is a hydrogen atom. On the carboxyl group, here's the OH group. That forms water, so this is a condensation. That's going to form a nice peptide bond right here. So it's a covalent bond. So you have a carbon to a double bond, carbon to nitrogen, nitrogen to a hydrogen right here, and then you get the alpha carbons on either side. This is an extremely stable covalent bond that we call a peptide bond. So proteins are very stable because this is a nice strong bond. And if we add three amino acids to make a tripeptide, what else is forming when we do this? How many waters? Three waters, okay. One, two, three, four amino acids, not three. Sorry, four amino acids joined together. We need three waters to come out. All right, so this is a peptide bond. And I should be having you draw this in lab this week on a blank piece of paper, but I forgot. So next week you'll do this in lab for extra credit. Just like you had to draw the response loop. All right, draw this out. I want to see that you know how to form a peptide bond by what? A dehydration synthesis type reaction in lab for next week. For extra credit, 1 point. All right, so if we have a protein with less than 100 amino acids, we call that a polypeptide. Typically, if it's greater than 100 amino acids, we call that a protein. That's a pretty loose designation. Okay, but it works really nice in our class. Okay, the protein structure can be defined in a number of different levels. All right, so here's that alpha carbon. Here's the amino group. Here's the functional group right here. Here's another amino acid right here. Here's a second functional group. And then here's another amino acid. So there are actually three amino acids that's making this long linear chain of this polypeptide. And this defines the primary structure of this particular protein. If we know what amino acid is in this location, and then the second location, and then third position, we know what the primary structure is. And the primary structure is going to be determined by what is happening on these functional groups right here. All right, so the primary structure is like the spelling of a particular protein word, right? How would you spell SIT? S-I-T, right? It's got three letters to it. Right, and that primary arrangement of those letters determines what the word is, which determines its meaning. If you know the primary structure of a protein, you know what amino acids are in what position, and that's going to help determine what the function of that particular protein is. All right, so the primary structure is really the spelling in amino acid vocabulary or letters, right? In amino acid letters, how you spell out a protein depending on what its particular amino acid is. That's what we call the primary structure. There are other structures. We're going to see secondary structure, tertiary structure, but we're going to carry on with that next time. Okay, primary structure is just the spelling in terms of amino acids that make a particular protein. Wow, that went by fast. I can't believe that went by so fast.